he didn't specify, but it doesn't mean
Bart Matson dancing.
And we'll propagate Krishna consciousness by having more Bart Matson dancers doing Bart Matson dancing. Now, that's certainly part of spiritual culture or cultural conquest. But at least the meaning that my understanding of Gita values conveys is it's spiritual culture, speaking in a broad sense. And spiritual culture has a set of values that go with it. I mentioned, I'll say it again, Lord Macaulay was a British gentleman who was sent by the British government to go visit India and explore the possibility of India becoming part of the British Commonwealth. That was in the 1830s. And he visited, and he came back and reported, recorded in the Parliament notes his speech. But his speech said, we have to break the culture of India if we're going to rule in India. They place so much value in their culture, we have to break the backbone of that culture and then we can rule India. So the spiritual culture of India is not just Bharatanatyam dancing or Karnataka dancing or something like that. It's the connection that the culture has, the culture of India previously had, is spiritual wisdom. Prabhupada didn't give Confucius his name, but he on many occasions said there's a Chinese scholar who said if you really want to know about spirituality, you have to go to India. The richness of the culture, the world has looked to India not only for spices and silks, but for spiritual culture. So spiritual culture has its values. And we're discussing Gita values to help understand how we, regardless of our nationality of birth, can fulfill the human mission. And the human mission being God-realization, self-realization, awakening our dormant consciousness, and shelter in Krishna. And we showed this slide before, the iceberg of culture. This is used by the image itself and the explanation is used by people that design what is called in the secular world as cultural engineering. We all know what engineering is. So cultural engineering is where the current culture of a group of people is such and such. It could be a company. It could be a whatever the group of people are. And to change the culture, one has to consider culture being like an iceberg, where there's at the top, there's observable behaviors and norms. Below that is your mission statement or your value statement or what you say, what you hope, what you believe to be important, your value system. Because behaviors rest upon values. From values, behaviors come. And if there's going to be consistency in behaviors, it's because there's a value beneath that makes that behavior consistent. If you want to change the tip, you have to change what's below the tip. And below that value section of the iceberg, there are deeply held beliefs, convictions, something that you can't change. that time and circumstance don't create or destroy or change. This deepest held, you know, we hold these truths to be self-evident. So, one way of looking at this is the heart, the mind, and the body. And there must be an alignment if you're going to have cultural change. So we're speaking about the values section of Bhagavad Gita, or spiritual culture, to go from material to spiritual culture. Materialistic way of the society, way the society is moving rapidly, and step outside of that, the flow going quick, swiftly down to going up, spiritual culture. So this, that's the function. The stated values, or explicit understood values of Bhagavad Gita to help in spiritual culture. We touched on this. At the bottom is information, that's what education today is. And above is wisdom. Like, I visited in China, and very prominent, very popular in China is traditional Chinese medicine. They really revere it. It turns out it's derived from Ayurveda, no surprise. But the systems that they use, and I mean, it looks different, but the root is the same. And traditional Chinese wisdom. And it's wisdom. And when I visit China, there's often this thing that goes back and forth between what's the similarity and difference between Buddhism and Bhagavad Gita, because I'm always... I'm often speaking the message of Bhagavad Gita. And in short, gee, this sounds a lot like what we already know. And Confucius wisdom and Lao Tzu wisdom. There's similarity in wisdom. There's similarity in knowledge, just like these items of knowledge from Bhagavad Gita, which we'll see more of shortly. This is section, chapter 13, where Krishna is responding to one of Arjuna's questions. What is knowledge? Jnanam, jnayam. Knowledge and the object of knowledge. So knowledge is quite similar. The object of knowledge is quite different. The object of knowledge in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, he's the object of knowledge. By the Vedas, I am to be known. So wisdom is more than information. So the values, Gita values, falls into this category of knowledge and wisdom. And wisdom is, like Chinese wisdom, it's a way of life. I mentioned this, but I found it interesting that in China, it's a very common thing for parents to want their children to get education in America, to even pay to have their child stay in high school in an American family home, so they can get into an American college, so they can get into graduate school and come back to China and make a lot of money. It's like this long-term project to get money. So that the education in the West is viewed as valuable. for people who want to make money in China. Because it's very different. Phenomenally, people that do their studies from China in America, nationalism is so strong, they want to go back and make China great. Real strong. It's a different kind of strong. But you know, that's the kind of strong it is. And at the same time, people in America like Confucius schools. So it's proliferating in America. Did I mention this already? Yes? The Chinese government is behind it. They sponsor, they're smart people, they sponsor the schools because schools cost money. So to get the schools started, they pay, they grant or loan money to have people go start a Confucius school that's popular in America. And it's popular in America because it's wisdom without God. Just like Buddhism is popular because it's spirituality without God. It's growing in popularity swiftly because it's godless. But it looks good. I mean, you know, nonviolence and other values. Because you look at the list in Bhagavad Gita, chapter 13, 8 through 12, and the question is, what is knowledge? And you look at the list and its qualities, or character, or values. In fact, one of them that we'll be discussing today is right at the top of the list of those items of knowledge. It's a way by which you live your life. Or Jnanam and Vijnanam, just like this image over here. This is the Jnanam side, and this is the Vijnana side, and there's a big gap in between the two. Liminal space. Where we are, where we want to be. The Gita values are teaching us where we want to be. And there's where we are. The process is the bhakti process. But there's this big gap between the two. And in between, or the goal of that process, is Krishna. And we have to bear that in mind as we're discussing Gita values. The values are not ends in themselves. The values are part and parcel of the consciousness of Krishna consciousness. If Bhagavad Gita was like Confucius' teachings, or Lao Tzu's teachings, it's wisdom that's godless. But Bhagavad Gita's message is not just the value in itself, it's something to help. It's a byproduct, it's part of the essence of Krishna consciousness. So, we discussed two values already. The first one was, you two boys in the front, without looking at your notes. What was the first value we discussed?
Cultural values?
Yes. Which is the first one we discussed? Sama? Sama? What's the second word? Darshana. Remember? Sama? Darshana. What's the meaning? Sama Darshana? Sama. Equal. Darshan. Equal vision. Equal vision. Equal vision. And we... It's resting upon the spiritual conception, although there's so many differences. The essence of sameness, the sama essence, is the soul within and super soul within. And then, because that sameness is there, we spend some time with that little exercise at the end. The holistic picture of differences is there's lots of sameness within those differences. then, oops, back again. Then from that first one, Samadarshana was humility, right? Amanagam. So this is ahimsa. Now, if we're going to be in the space of seeing one another with equal vision, we need to have a sense of being able to relate according to that equal vision, spirit, soul, within, etc. So this principle, it's a quality or it's a value of nonviolence. And there's the presence of violence. Can we turn these lights? Human history shows records of violence or the use of force going back as far as there's time. And the form that it takes is different today, but it's proliferating all too much. Not a new thing. And why does something like this happen? And how is this something related or not related to equal vision? Equal vision. Voice? What's the Sanskrit for equal vision?
Samadarshana.
Samadarshana. So I want to make the connection between Samadarshana or equal vision and nonviolence. Is there or is there not a correlation? Is one related to the other or relying upon the other? And why does it happen? Traditionally, a conception of nonviolence is we act in a way that causes the least harm. You know, the way that I understood this as a teenager was if you can live your life in such a way you're causing less pain and suffering to others, that's a better way to live. Very simple. Principle of none. That's what's inspired me to go from being a non-vegetarian to vegetarian, just this one principle. It's a better way to live. Jivo, jivasya, jivanam. From the Sanskrit phrase, one living entity subsists or survives at the expense of another living entity. That's the arrangement of nature. There's the beauty of nature and there's the cruelty of nature. One living entity subsists at the expense of other living entities. So since our existence requires to some degree, at least unavoidably, by nature's arrangement, we're living at the expense of other living entities. That if other living entities can suffer less just due to my existence, it's not an option to go out of existence. Because even if you annihilate the body, the soul moves on to another body. You can't stop encroaching on others' space of comfort, like going out of existence. You can't do that. Not an option. So if others suffer less, that's a good principle to live by. Avoiding violence. And again, on the negative sense, what not to do. And the various levels, physical, verbal, emotional level. Don't create physical violence, verbal violence, emotional violence. And they're different, but they're to be avoided. So this non-violence principle, the ahimsa principle, applies. Some years ago, I remember when Chaturatma was living at the temple, Chaturatma and his wife, really good cook, and the restaurant was the main source of income for the temple. And so one of the things that he did, Chaturatma, was really good at making friends with people outside from different communities. So the Buddhist community is a group that he made friendship with. So there was a table in the restaurant, and they had their literature in the restaurant. And one of them was the Buddhist temple. And in big letters on their flyer, like fold-out flyer, was ahimsa. And it was in the Sanskrit word. This is the chief teaching of Buddha. Like, that's their godhood, is the value, nonviolence. But there's another perspective that Bhagavad Gita presents besides this one. Do you want to know what it is? You sure? Okay, good. Nonviolence is generally taken to mean not killing or destroying the body, but actually nonviolence means not to put others and oneself also into distress. So, we discussed this before. If you're a Buddhist, what do you believe the root cause of suffering is? The root cause of suffering is desire. And so Buddha's teaching is, if you want to become free from suffering, become free from desire. And to become free from desire, how do you do it? It's two main things. Frame your life in goodness, compassion, nonviolence, etc., etc. It doesn't say the mode of goodness, but it's the mode of goodness. Live your life in the mode of goodness. And then do meditation. And meditation, the conventional term for Buddhist meditation is mindfulness. In society, it's become a very popular world, a word, the mindful manager. And mindful eating, mindful walking. This is kind of like green, it's a buzz, it's a marketing term. So, mindfulness arises from Buddhism, and it's a mindfulness of being in the moment. Because the past is gone and the future hasn't happened, the only thing that's happening is the moment. So be in the moment, be mindful of the moment. And when you become really good at being in the moment, what's next is to go on the other side of the moment. And what's on the other side of the moment? Nirvana. When you really become proficient as a Buddhist, you enter into this beyond the moment space called Nirvana. And Nirvana means cessation of material existence or cessation of material activity. That's the meaning of the Sanskrit word. He borrowed words from Sanskrit, although he rejected the Vedas. And Bhagavad Gita's teaching is quite different, similar, but different. And Bhagavad Gita's teaching is the root cause of suffering, I'm emphasizing this word here, not put others into distress. So the root cause of suffering is ignorance. And from ignorance comes ignorant desire. From ignorant desire comes ignorant activity, comes suffering. So, since the root cause of suffering is ignorance, the way to become relieved from suffering is relieve one of ignorance. And so there's knowledge. Bhagavad Gita is a book of knowledge, or wisdom. But it's practically applied knowledge and wisdom that then becomes vijnana. And to not put others into distress which is what it says here, is to relieve them of ignorance. Because if you don't relieve them of ignorance, then you're propagating or furthering or you're... There are different terms these days. You're, a co-partner in the ignorance program. Although your intention can be nice. Motive goodness, nice. Nice, 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 perfumed with a bow and a ribbon and it's ignorance. That's Bhagavad Gita. Without mayaya paritigyana, a learned person that doesn't understand the purpose of that knowledge is in ignorance. And there's that real knowledge in the Bhagavad Gita sense of knowledge, is stolen by illusion. That real knowledge is who are you, the goal and purpose of being in the quality of goodness, the goal and purpose of values, the objective, where's the train going when you get on the train of goodness, what's the destination. Like this long discussion Prabhupada had with Professor Durkheim, a nice German professor that had a very affectionate relationship with Prabhupada, and so they would regularly go for walks together, and he recorded and then transcribed their discussions. So one of those room conversations with Professor Durkheim was an argument or a disagreement where Durkheim was arguing knowledge for knowledge's sake. He's a professor. Mode of goodness professor, not the other lower modes of nature type. But Prabhupada was disagreeing and saying, not knowledge for knowledge's sake, knowledge has to have a purpose. And he went back and forth and back and forth. Prabhupada finally became a little irritated and let him have it. But it's not knowledge for knowledge's sake. It's to make people happy. Sarve sukhino bhavantu. Everyone should be happy. Chant and be happy. It was listen to lots of Prabhupada's lectures and you'll hear that message. He doesn't necessarily say the phrase, although many times he would say that phrase. But that was his intention. The purpose, the mission was a mission of nonviolence, a mission of relieving people of their suffering and distress, relieving people of ignorance. Now sometimes to relieve people of ignorance, Prabhupada would be really heavy. Just like we're reading in the Bhagavatam of Jed Bharat speaking to Rahugana. And wow, he's heavy. Like smash. Because when one is expecting happiness through fruitive activities and cultivation of wealth through fruitive activities, dharma, artha, for the purpose of kama, the one who believes in all that, then spiritual culture isn't going to take place. Just listening this morning, Prabhupada speaking of a verse. It's quoted in chapter 2 of Bhagavad Gita in a purport. But Madhavendra Puri, anybody here not know who is Madhavendra Puri? Well, no, you don't know. Okay. You know who is Lord Chaitanya? Lord Chaitanya's spiritual master's name was Ishwara Puri. And Ishwara Puri's spiritual master was named Madhavendra Puri. In the same line of the Siddhic succession, in the line of Madhvacharya, Madhavendra Puri. And he became super excellent Paramahamsa Sannyasi, topmost devotee. And he he makes reference to this, I'm no longer interested in basically, you know, the flowery language of the Vedas, as Krishna says. Fruitive activities that bring elevation. Prabhupada's commentary was, it's enticement. Here's what Prabhupada said. Just like parents commonly will encourage their children, get a good education. Because by getting a good education, you can get a good occupation. By having a good occupation, you can have a good income. By having a good income, you can live comfortably. So get a good education. The Prabhupada is using the word repeatedly, enticement. So similarly, the Vedas have enticements. You do this yajna and this ritual and that procedure, the flowery language of the Vedas, and you'll get prosperity in this life and the next life. It's an enticement. But Madhavendra Puri was saying, I have no attraction for those things anymore, because I'm finding satisfaction simply in being engaged in loving service at the feet of Govinda. Now, it doesn't mean that you don't act responsibly in the world, but the enticement feature to keep me going as perks to go further and further on the path of Dharma, Artha, Kama. Bhakti is beyond that enticement stage. It must be, say it negatively, if it stays within that field of enticement or material enjoyment, that's the anchor, and no matter how much you row, you're not going to make any progress in your rowboat. You have to lift the anchor. And then it's not that there's not prosperity or facilities, but the purpose of those facilities is service to Krishna only. At least as bhakti grows, that's the spirit of bhakti, whether one is a householder or a Madhavendra Puri Paramahamsa Sannyasi. The spirit is the pleasure of Krishna. So, to relieve people of distress, that's really what nonviolence is. People in general are trapped by ignorance in the material concept of life. Prabhupada's words. And they perpetually suffer material pains. The image is the ostrich sticks his hand, the head in the sand. Here comes some danger. Whoa, stick your head in the sand. So remaining in ignorance in the material conception of life, people are not able to go beyond the material pains. They have to experience them again and again and again, lifetime after lifetime, remaining in ignorance. This is Prabhupada speaking on this Ahimsa principle. Many times people don't know what actually benefits them and what is beneficial for human society in general. Again, from Bhagavad Gita chapter, this is chapter 10. Not te vidu svartikatini vishnu, Prabhat Maharaj. You just read it this morning for food. People don't know what is the goal of life, and not knowing what the goal of life is, that's ignorance. And so it becomes ignorant activity, becomes suffering. It's dominoes, boom, boom, boom. The human body is meant for spiritual realization. So any movement or any commissions which do not further that end, commit violence on the human body. That which furthers the future spiritual happiness of the people in general is called nonviolence. That's this sarve sukhi no bhavantu. That's nonviolence, is propagate Krishna consciousness. relieve people of knowledge, excuse me, relieve people of ignorance through spiritual knowledge, spiritual culture. That's a Gita value. And spiritual ignorance causes alienation amongst people, within the person and in interpersonal activity. Hence the means, again, Bhagavad Gita chapter 10, that people should be trained in such a way that the full utilization of the human body can be achieved, and that it is possible, and how to do it. That's nonviolence. That's relieving people of their suffering. And if so, here's a very simple example, really simple one. Supposing there's a medical doctor, he has his degree, he knows how to cure people, and he's leaving the hospital, going home, he's walking along the sidewalk with a little black bag, and in his little black bag are all his medical instruments and supplies and stuff. And he sees on the sidewalk there's somebody writhing on the sidewalk, hemorrhaging or, you know, flailing in pain. He just keeps walking. Now, he knows how to help relieve the person of their suffering, at least minimally. But he doesn't attend to it. He has the knowledge, but he doesn't administer that knowledge. Indirectly, that's violence. Or non-violence would be to administer what's needed. Supposing you're walking along the street and you see a bully beating up on a little kid. You just keep walking. Well, not my business. You can't. You can't do that. You know, what are you going to do? At least, you know, 911. You may not have to get in there and try to stop the bully from beating the kid. I saw this once. You got to do something. And if you don't do something, that perpetrates furthering the violence. It's a big deal, gun violence. What are you going to do about it? We're just like citizens. We're just little people. What are we going to do about it? You have to propagate knowledge. Because where's this violence arising from? From ignorance. People are suffering due to ignorance. What are you going to do about it? Well, we don't stick our head in the sand. What are we going to do about it? We're little people. What are we going to do about it? Systematically propagate Krishna consciousness. Okay, so now we're ready for our exercise time. You ready?
Yeah.
Okay. The rest of the evening is exercise time. Part of it is going to be fun, and part of it is you have to do some work.
Yeah. Can we try
on
the light? If you're you can all take out a piece of paper and a pen, or even your phone, you can write in the notes app. We're going to be doing some personal exercises. I'm going to request you all to think of a situation in your life where you felt non-acceptance of yourself or others because of how you or they reacted to a certain situation. So basically, you're going to think of a situation in your life where you felt that someone was treated in a violent way, or you were treated in a violent way. This is not like, I mean, if it was something physical, you could write it down, but this is more thinking of like mental or emotional violence. you can take a few minutes to think about it and write it down. Okay, so as you are writing this down, you can really just think about what your feelings were. Were you feeling guilty or ashamed, angry, frustrated, depressed? And also write down your feelings from that situation. So now we're going to do a little bit of reflection on that situation. So when you were affected by that violent interaction, what did you need at that time? So behind any negative emotion, there is an unmet need. When that need was unmet, that's how you felt the negative emotion from that situation. So here we have a pyramid of the needs that we feel on a day-to-day basis. So on the bottom we have physiological needs. So the lack of food, the lack of shelter might bring a negative emotion of feeling needing to feel protected. Or the second one from the bottom is safety and security. So job security is a big need that brings up negative emotions. The third one is love and belonging. So everyone has the need to love and to be loved. And when we have the lack of that, that brings up negative emotions. The third one is self-esteem. So the lack of confidence, achievement, the lack of respect from our peers, that brings up negative emotions also. And then finally we have at the top, self-actualization, which is when we really doubt our morality or creativity and we really feel like we let ourselves down. So this is the pyramid of our needs. And so based off of this, you can write down from in your reflection what was a need that was unmet in that particular situation that you faced. Does that make sense? If you have any questions, please feel free to call out.
I'm going to say something before we go on. You need more time to write down?
Yes.
Okay. Some of you may have attended the Gita Nagari retreat the last 2 years. Here Krishna Maharaj was a presenter presenting non-violent communication. The term non-violent communication came from the work of Marshall Rosenberg, a gentleman who lived in the counterculture era and then beyond. And he had developed a school, like a system for teaching non-violent communication during the period of time when the Vietnamese War and following all of that, you know, a major wave of concern about not only physical violence, but communication violence. So he became very popular. He recently left his body. But two devotees I know studied very carefully under him. One of them was Vrajalila, who lives in Gita Nagari, disciple of Bhakti Tirtha Swami, part of his institute for spiritual education and training for IFAST. So she studied Marshall Rosenberg's teachings, as did Dear Krishna Maharaj, with the idea of learning this method of nonviolent communication and then Krishnaizing it and teaching it to the devotee community. And they've been doing it. So a core, really core message in nonviolent communication is needs. That's why this language is here. That we have needs and others have needs, and if you don't know what your needs are, or let's say it negatively, when there's a conflict, sometimes the conflict between two people has to do with an unmet need. And so the behavior is over here, but the unmet need is really what's behind the behavior. So it's similar here. Behind a negative emotion, there's a need that's not being met. So it's important, this question, this slide, is important. In nonviolent communication, you need to know, you must know, what your needs are that are not being met. When there's a negative emotion, and then negative emotion can cause conflict in relationships. This is this flow from samadarshana to ahimsa. Seeing with spiritual vision ourselves and others, and then having relationships that are based upon that spiritual vision of ourselves and others. And so you can then communicate appropriately. I have a need, and this need isn't being met. One of our members here shared with me they had this negative emotion. Something happened, and they felt this negative emotion, and they didn't know exactly how to manage that negative emotion and deal with the person who was the instrument of that, triggered that negative emotion, and how do I handle the situation? It's part of nonviolent communication. What's your need? And what's the other person's need? And you, once you understand one another's need, then you can have a nonviolent communication over that and see if you can work it out. But if you don't understand your needs and they don't know your needs, and you, they don't know their needs, then you're going to have dysfunctional communication, not nonviolent communication, or ahimsa. Empathic communication was the title of this course. But with this, all this background of the blah blah I just did, is to put this slide in context with nonviolent communication.
Do you also need some more time to write it down? So next we're going to be doing a meditative exercise to kind of reflect on the situation that brought violence into your, violent communication into your life. So first, I'd like to request all of you to close your eyes and really, really try to focus on that need that was unmet when you felt offended or hurt. And I would like you all to look at yourself as a bird that is sitting inside of a cage. And you're trying to get all of your needs met by others. And I want you to reflect on how that makes you feel, as everyone is around you trying to fulfill all of your needs. So now you can open your eyes and you can have a quick discussion on how that made you feel. Did that make you feel disempowering or empowering? Do you have any volunteers to go through?
It made myself more aware of my need.
So you were able to really think about all the different needs that you have every day. Is that what you're
saying? At least one important need.
Okay. And so did that make you feel like disempowered or very empowered about yourself?
I'll share something, not specific to me, but in my life, in my moving around in our Hare Krishna movement. 2 weeks ago, I got a letter from this fantastic devotee couple who I've known for probably 2 decades. And he's wonderful, she's wonderful, they have a wonderful son. They're looked up to because they've been around for some years. They're looked up to by the community around them as guides and mentors and, you know, awesome people. And because I know the family very well, there's some struggle in their marriage. And so the wife was writing, keeping it short. She's been struggling and struggling and struggling and struggling and struggling and struggling. And she kind of like emotionally checked out. It's because she felt, here I am being looked up to by our community members and I'm struggling. And I'm struggling in a really fundamental way. So she went into this discomfort space, negative emotion space about herself and her situation. And she started reading Chaitanya Charitamrita and hearing about the pastimes and loving exchanges of Lord Chaitanya and his devotees. And it was like this dark cloud that had been covering her emotional space suddenly started to lift. And as it lifted, her realization was that exactly this. I was expecting my husband to meet my needs. And because he wasn't meeting my needs, this negative emotion was coming. And I was feeling negative emotion towards him. But the real problem was, I wasn't seeing him. I was seeing him as an object meant to meet my needs. And as soon as I let go of that false expectation that he is to meet my needs, then I can start to see him. And when I look at him, here's what I see. And she was describing what she's... But I had lost sight of him. It was all about me and my needs, and he's supposed to meet my needs. And so this negative... Behind the negative emotion was a need that was unmet. And it's unrealistic to expect someone to meet your needs. Like, I got these needs. And so she was like the bird in the cage, feeling imprisoned with negative emotion towards someone who is really a wonderful person and which she had lost sight of. So her new paradigm is, let me respect my husband for who he really is, and let me find out a practical way that my needs can be met, other than by an unrealistic expectation of his meeting my needs. This is a core part, those of you that took the seminar, two parts, it's a core part of empathic relationships, where you know what your needs are, and you make a strategy to meet your needs, and it has to be a realistic one, without projecting expectations on somebody else to meet your needs. So this slide is following the previous slide for a purpose. It's on the ahimsa topic. Empathic communication or nonviolent communication or nonviolence to yourself and to others.
So all those exercises and the conditions, all these gears, and also watching this video, it helps me and today also. The small topics, whatever I was holding on to, it helps me to get rid of it and be aware of the points, whatever we discussed. And in the application part also, to be more empowered to the values, what has been discussed, helping to empower these people, empowering me, and able to come out of my holdings. And I feel like very nice and peace.
So this exercise
is empowering for me.
Yeah. For you.
Okay.
Yes,
sir. Sometimes I feel like we have a difficult situation where I am here, that person is here. So both of us doesn't want much, but after a while, going through if we say we don't talk or we just have a gap for some months or something, and then say I am prepared to come down. Okay, when I do that, what I feel is the other person take me for granted, and they overpower you. And you want to overpower me. That is the situation I face most of the time. Not even in the congregation, but even in the office situation. That is the kind of situation. You are prepared to come down and accept and move forward, but they are not prepared to do that. How do you handle the situation?
Well, I like, there's many things one can do, but if I remember, or if you remind me, I'll send you this one-page thing that was Mother Teresa put on her wall in an orphanage in Calcutta. That's one of the lines says, if people do like that, act in goodness anyways. Mm-hmm. Because after all, it's between you and Krishna. It's not about you and the other person. She she doesn't use exactly that language, but that's what she's saying. The real issue is not between you and that person. The real issue is between you and Krishna. Our mission in life, the human mission, is to restore our relationship with Krishna. Everything channeled towards that. Now there may be some times that it's appropriate to be silent and to be strong and this and that, but the purpose is to please Krishna, not to prevail in a conflict, and if I show a little sign of weakness, they'll walk all over me. Let them walk all over you. I mean, maybe not. The goal is to please Krishna. And it takes strength to be able to be in that position. It's an inner strength, a spiritual strength, a Balaram strength. To be able to be okay with that. Because Krishna knows, and my relationship with Krishna is secure, and that's what's important to me. And that's my need, is that my relationship with Krishna is secure. And then, outside, the modes of nature are going on. Having a party. Mode of ignorance over there, the mode of passion over there, and combination over there. And the world is modes of nature. That's not going to change. Let me just be in my relationship with Krishna. Let that Krishna connection be strong. That's my need. And I have a strategy how to fulfill that need. I'll think wisely as much as my capacity provided by Krishna permits, how to best be in service to this other person rather than, try to win the arm wrestling match. What a dull existence that is.
I feel sitting in that cage and trying to expect you that your needs are met by others, I feel that is more disempowering, because I don't have any strategy to meet my need and I don't have any plan.
Yeah.
Just expecting that needs to be satisfied, I don't think it is going to happen. So that's too disempowering for me.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, good.
Now we're going to do an exercise to kind of flip that way of thinking and make ourselves feel empowered by fulfilling our needs. So now I'd like to request you all to close your eyes again. And we're going to go back to that situation that you felt was very violent. And look at that situation and look at yourself and look at the other person who's also there. And now we're going to apply the first principle that we learned, which is Samadarshana, and we're going to see ourselves as well as the other person as a spirit soul. And now we're I would like you to reflect that the body that you and the other person is in, the resultant emotions, your needs, and their needs are all covering. It is all a reaction of the field of activities and its interactions in the material world. So now you can all open your eyes. And from this sacred meditative space, I would like to request you to please see how your vision of yourself and the other person in that situation has changed from non-acceptance to acceptance, to respect and to service, and how from having the idea of meeting your needs from the sacred space to where expectations and frustrations are replaced with the mood of respect and service. Does that make sense? So if you all please write down a little reflection that you feel after this exercise. How from thinking of that one situation that disturbed your mind and it brought with you feelings of depression and anger and frustration, to now how you can look back at that situation and see not someone who offended you, but a spirit soul who's only trying to serve. So as we finish up writing, we can reflect on this quote, that the full realization of our spiritual nature is to become connected with the real us, spirit souls, and to the divine nature, Krishna. And that once we are connected to ourselves as the spirit souls and we are gradually connecting ourselves back to Krishna, we can see how the Bhagavad Gita verse 5:18, how the humble sages by virtue of true knowledge see with equal vision Samadarshana, a learned and gentle Brahmana, a cow, an elephant, a dog, and a dog eater, all as spirit souls.
There's another exercise coming at the end, and I want to make a couple comments. Two comments. One is, as practicing devotees, sadhakas, where we haven't reached the goal yet, we have a philosophy that's very exalted. And our capacity isn't there yet. So within ourselves as individuals and in our communities collectively, there's this big gap. And to make that gap become less, it starts with yourself. Part of the mistake of our devotee community is we expect others to be way up there, well, we're not. And we project, you know, frustration and negative emotion on persons that aren't way up there yet. When the reality is, if we were more way up there, we would be in a better position to help other people come up there. But the problem is, we're not. The problem is over here, not over there. I had this nice experience in China. We had this one devotee that's been around for umpteen years, and they finally moved to the stage of initiation. Really nice devotee. So Is it just in someone's living room? Because that's how we had a program. There's no scent or anything like that. So it was that time when somebody was called upon to say some words of appreciation of that devotee. And like everybody wanted to say something of appreciation about that devotee because there's so much to be appreciated about them. And it was really like lovely. The enthusiasm that the devotees had to say their appreciation for this, and the individual looking down, and like it was hard for them to hear all this praise and appreciation because that they were humble, not like getting recognition here. So a comment, a feeling that I had when this was going on is we not like the Hare Krishna movement should be a mutual praise and adoration society. However, it is good to express our appreciation and gratitude and recognition of others because we do too much of the other. Meaning, you know, when this feedback that was one of our role plays. Appreciation, appreciation, room for improvement, appreciation. That's a standard. And when there's negative emotion, when people say room for improvement, that's where your attention goes. And we do a lot of that, room for improvement, Prabhu. And that, that has its place. But we don't enough express, emote, convey our feelings of appreciation for one another, whether it's in a family or in a community or however the circles go around. Like this example, this devotee couple that I was mentioning. So, something that will help us as individuals become closer to what the value of Bhagavad Gita is not feel, oh, I'm not at that values stage yet. I'm way down here instead of way up there. And then feeling disempowered. Our sadhana process, just by hearing, because Arjuna, we presented this the first evening, he was really had big time negative emotions. His body was trembling and his bow slipped from his hand, big hero. Helpless, hopeless. So by hearing from Krishna, he went on the other side. And so we need to cultivate these values and we need one another's association and we need to recognize the value that that association has for us and not simply become focused on where the shortcomings are that don't match what those values are. Then one other comment is, as I was hearing, because Shatrupa is the one that prepared all this. You know who Shatrupa is. Many of you do. This Gita values message, I just passed it on to her and said, get creative. And she got creative and the values. And gathered from messages from Dear Krishna Maharaj's, nonviolent communication. That's going to be this role play that comes at the end. And we better stop because of time. But it's just Bhagavad Gita's message. Like, that little exercise of close your eyes and see the other person. And it's Bhagavad Gita chapter 13, text 6 and 7. It's the 24 elements and their interaction. And the interaction creates emotion. Read it when you go home or tomorrow or something. Bhagavad Gita chapter 13, 6 and 7. When there's a list of the 24 elements and their interactions. And the interactions create emotions. And that's what's going on in life. People that don't have samadarshana, they don't have a spiritual conception, they're just caught up in that stuff. And we're not at that high stage yet. We're still at the mixed stage somewhere. And to advance, for us to advance on the path of bhakti, we have to go more to the reflecting on who we really are and reflecting who the other person is and be in the mood of service for our needs and the service and the needs of others and relate that way for the pleasure of Krishna. It's really practical. And sometimes, so this is my comment, sometimes we're not so practical. Sometimes we're theoretical. More than sometimes. Because most of you are from India, I'll share this kind of like an inside joke. For those of that preach at colleges in India, the students of highly challenging technical schools in India are so, the kids are so impractical, they don't know how to tie their shoes. They know like abstract stuff like anything. But when it comes to, you know, being clean or anything, that, you know, their training has gone way over there and they don't know how to turn left or right. Just one example. I requested someone to get a lota, and they brought back a flower vase. And the person who was in charge of that little gathering said, you know, it's like this all the time. Because it's just, you know, anyway. It's part of the education today. It's information, 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 no transformation. It's not practical. And we approach, not like we're all cerebral people like that, but we approach Krishna Bhakti in a way that's not connected with the practical application part. We know the philosophy more than people who aren't devotees. We know the philosophy. But the application gap is really big. We're not the body. We know the philosophy. And do we live our lives that way? Do we have our interactions that way? A big gap. So, because this is the third time I've been through this with the Gita Values topic, it's becoming more and more clear to me as I go through it several times that I plan to do some more of it. It's just, take the information, the yan, and bring it inside. Let it become big yan. Let it become the way that we live our life. Not easy. That's our project. Many of you in your workplace are probably project managers. Manage this project, your life. Okay.
Oh, my, that's the next slide is for you too.
Is it? Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah. So, this is where nonviolence starts. You know, your heart. We had a youth gathering in Chicago right after school finished, so like the third week of June. Some of the kids from here went, some of the youth from here. And one of the topics I was asked to speak about, I wanted to change it, maybe like self-love. Amongst young people today, that's, you know, that's a topic. I don't want to talk about that because it's narcissism. And love requires two in any case. Love and the object of love, and then the feelings of love. So how can we have self-love? But, you know, self-worth, that, I'll talk about that. So that's what I spoke about. So it connects the very same, you know, what are your needs? If you know what your needs are, and you have, you know, this immediate core of persons that you associate with a lot, like family, and, you know, family, strong family units make a strong community. And family is not a strong family unit. It's part of the problem for the community to help work with. But it starts at home. Charity begins at home. And home is right here. And then the nonviolence, and then the circle expands, community, society, and then the circle expands, community, circle expands, all species of life. I found very interesting that Albert Einstein says this. If you want to become a free thinker, like Albert Einstein, we can't rip without our capacity. But he said that we have to free ourselves to become compassionate to the whole of existence. And then our thinking capacity becomes truly free. That's big. And you know, we gotta start here. And if you do this well, then you can do the next one well, then you can do the next one well. But it has to start inside. So that's where this nonviolence starts, or ahimsa starts, and then it expands into interpersonal relationships. Okay. Here she goes.
So that exercise that we did earlier was kind of like serious. So this is our more fun exercise where we're going to see, like, Tuesday we're going to have some skits and we're going to discuss what we see in the skits. So the role plays today are going to demonstrate effective communication, like empathetic communication, versus harsh or non-empathetic communication. So for our first skit, it's going to do the non-empathetic communication, and so it's an example of that. And in
the word is empathic.
Empathic communication. Yeah, I even said that and just read it wrong. And there are four types of non-empathic communication. And so the first one is deserve, and so when you're talking to someone, you kind of put yourself higher than them, like you deserve something. And then the second one is demand, so you're demanding something from that person. The third one is diagnosis, or putting a label on someone. And then the fourth one is denial of responsibility. So in our first skit, we're going to see examples of all four, and then we're going to kind of dissect what's going on and which examples we saw and things like that. So for our first skit, can I please have Rajeshwari Pramadnathji and Srihari? We can give them a big round of applause.
Gifted school, so you can study well, and you can become a doctor. you can make a good living, and then you can take care of Amma when Amma become old, right?
I guess it's not in your karma that you don't have a perfect son.
You don't understand that. I don't want you to struggle in life. If you become a doctor, you can have a good life, and you don't have to struggle.
Why are you so materialistic, Amma? You should practice what you preach.
I know. For you, it's easy to say that because your life is easy now because we are providing everything for you now. So
I don't want to become a doctor. I can become like an artist. That's a more simple job.
What are you talking? That's a hobby for rich people. That's not even a profession. What my family will say if you become an artist instead of a doctor?
You don't understand, Amma. I don't want to speak to you.
Okay, so from that example is clearly an example of
the
non-empathic communication. Good job. And so what was the example? The first one was over dessert. What was an example of dessert?
Take care of
an old age, because she expected that from her son, like she deserved her son, which, I mean, you should do that, I guess, but she felt like she deserved that from him. What was an example of demand?
You have to become a doctor.
Yes, you have to become a doctor. What was an example of diagnosis? Putting a label on someone.
Becoming an artist is not going to help.
That's also a good example. There was a specific word that Srihari called his mom.
Materialistic.
Yeah, so that's a diagnosis. He labeled his mom materialistic. And then finally, what is the denial of responsibility? The denial of responsibility was that she gave all of she told her son, like, you have to do this, you have to do that, you have to do this, but she didn't take any, like, I will help you with something. If you don't want to be a doctor, I will help you become an artist. Like, that's a denial of responsibility. Does that make sense? Is there any questions? Okay. We can give our wonderful actors. Okay. So for our next example.
Before we go to the next example, I found that very interesting role playing. And where it came from was Dear Krishna Maharaj.
Yeah.
For those of you that did not attend, I was not there for that segment. It was so popular, so much appreciated what he was doing, that we had part two, like the whole weekend. And so in part two, I requested him have a 2.5-hour segment where it's role play, where people take the concept and give it life. So it's not just cerebral or information, but they can see it playing out. So these role plays are one role plays that he came up with to help the audience understand the message of nonviolent communication or empathic communication. So you did a good job.
So for our second example, we're going to see one skit, but it'll be split in two parts. And so we're going to see which one was the violent communication, which one was the non-violent communication, and kind of dissect that. Also, disclaimer, like, all these skits are just, like, made up by Dear Krishna Maharaj and his disciples and devotees. It's not, like, reflecting anyone in, like, anyone's real life or anything. So for our next I'd like to welcome Shari Mataji and Krishna Swarup.
helped with them.
Hey, them.
Okay, really, really, awesome. Okay, and go.
Did you cook today?
No, I did not cook today.
You always lock out. It's your duty to cook for me. What was the marriage vow we took? You want to serve, serve, serve me only.
Marriage vow? It is not like you are perfect.
You are always criticizing me.
You are always judgmental.
Don't we all have to do things we don't like to do? I hate going to work. I hate travel. But I have to do it because I'm a husband, I'm a father. You are just like your mother.
That's it. Stop it. Don't ever bring up my mom in this.
You are just too sensitive.
Okay. Yay. So now we're going to do the next skit. And start.
Did you cook today?
No, I'm so sorry. I couldn't able to cook today.
Sounds like you might have had a busy day.
I did. You know, your daughter Shriniti grew up all night. We both did not sleep at all. I'm so exhausted and tired.
Oh my, I'm very sorry to hear that. Are you feeling overwhelmed? I know it's not easy when I'm out of town. Thank you for managing all these things alone, daughter.
Thank you for understanding me. You know what? You can make a solution. You can take Shriniti for some time to park or somewhere, so I can make a nice dinner for both of us, for three of us.
Okay, Okay, so we have the two examples that were on two totally different ends of a spectrum. And so let's talk about the first one. What was the first one an example of? Yes,
Helen? Very, very violent.
Very, very violent. Correct. And so what were some things that were said or done that made you think that it was very, very violent? Yes,
diagnosis. I think Mother T called him judgmental.
Yes.
So probably kind of labeling.
Yeah. Yes, please.
The tone itself, the way they spoke between each other, the conversation between them, is like at this level.
Yeah.
They're not respecting each other.
Yeah, that's a very good word. There was no respect in that example. Yes, ma'am.
They both behaved in a way that I deserve more than you.
Yeah, and so that also goes to one of the qualities of non-empathic communication, which is deserving.
And also there's a demand. Did you cook today?
Yes. Serve, serve, serve. Right. Yeah. And then there's also...
Labeling.
And then there was also a denial of responsibility. Did we catch that?
Yes, I don't have to cook because I have some excuses.
Yes, yeah. Which is, I know, like, nowadays, like, you know, like, women don't belong in the kitchen or stuff like that. This is just, like, an example. So. And then in the second skit, what was that an example of? Empathic communication, yes. And, what were some things that were said or done that made you think that?
Too polite. Respectful to each other.
Understanding.
Yeah, understanding.
Understanding between both of them. Each one understood each one's needs. So
yeah, needs.
Yes.
That's
needs,
very
yeah.
good point.
Yeah.
And the situation was dealt very nicely, even though they had a tough time.
Yeah. Okay, that's very good. And so that leads us into our third and final skip. And so now we're going to see just an example of plain empathic communication and where everything is very non-violent. And so when we talk about empathic communication, there are four steps in that, like we had in non-empathic communication. And the four steps are observation, which is like observing what the other person is saying clearly. Oftentimes when people come to us with like feedback or like grievances, we just kind of brush over what they're saying, but it's very important to observe like their behavior, their body language, and see how they're feeling about what they're seeing. And that goes into the second point, which is feelings. And so it's really important that we take the other person, who's another spirit soul, take their feelings into consideration, and they should also take the other person's, like our feelings, into consideration. The third one is needs, and so it's really important to see that when someone comes to you with a grievance, that they, behind every like complaint or negative emotion, like we saw, there is a need that is unmet. So it's very important that we take that extra step to recognize and reflect on the need that they are having unmet. And then the final one is a request. And so it's really important that we take the time to see what the other person is requesting and see if we can fulfill that request, which also fulfills their need. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. And so to have our third and final skit of like Dana Prabhu and Bo Prabhu, please. Dana Gopal Prabhu is a temple president and Bo Prabhu is a devotee coming, or there.
Vishnu Das is sick today. Prabhu, would you please consider cooking a temple feast, a festival feast today?
No, Prabhu. I have my Ramchitran.
You have your Ramchitran. That is wonderful. So we all have a need for spiritual advancement, and we have to keep up our vows that we committed with our spiritual master, so I completely understand.
Yes, Prabhu. I've been so busy preparing for Balaram Jayanti, buying flowers, decorating the altar, planning Abhishek. I slept at 1 a.m. last night. I wasn't able to wake up early today. I have all 16 rounds remaining.
Prabhu, I so much appreciate all you do in the Pujari department. The darshan was fantastic today. All your hard work that you put in last night into the flower decorations is really evident in the gorgeous altar you have seen today.
Thank you, Prabhu. I sometimes feel like no one notices anything I do.
Are you feeling sad because you have a need for appreciation?
Yes.
I know I could be better at appreciating devotees' services. I truly appreciate the amount of effort you put in different services.
Thank you. You know what, Prabhu? I need only 2 hours to chant. If you can find someone to cut the vegetables for the next 2 hours, I can chat and then cook.
You'll be tired.
No. I slept in this morning. Give me 2 hours only, and I'll be back.
That's great, Prabhu. I'll get a team to cut the vegetables, but you know, only you can be the chief cook. It's another one of your special gifts.
So what was that an example of?
Empathic communication.
Yay. And what were the four steps that I had said earlier? Observation.
Feelings.
Needs. And requests. So how did we see that in the skin? How did we see observation?
In observation, when Gopal Prabhu appreciated the Baladev Prabhu's pujari work and all the effort we put into celebrate the Balaramji.
Yeah. It's observation. Yeah. And that's very good, Mahatji. Thank you. And then what is the feelings.
So I think Prabhu was expecting that he should get appreciation, like he was feeling that he was doing all the work and he needed some kind of appreciation. He was expecting that, so.
Yeah.
That's the need.
Yeah, he even asked, like, you have a need for appreciation. Yeah, no one noticed everything that he had done. And so that goes into directly his needs. For he does all this work, and there's no one who really comes and appreciates. So what did he immediately do when he found that out?
Appreciate.
Yeah, he appreciated. The session was beautiful today. And then what was the request?
2 hours of chanting.
Yes. And then to get some people to cut that out. So yeah. So we do skits like this because it's very easy to just like hear about it in class and then be like, oh, I'm going to apply it next time it happens. But when something like this might be a realistic situation, when we're put into a situation like that, like it doesn't come easily to us. And that's why when we do skits like this, and Vir Krishna Maharaj does skits like this, it really helps us reflect on everything that we do next and everything that comes next in our way and really apply the Gita principles that we learned. So yeah, and I also want to say, thank you for allowing me to stand up here. I definitely was very nervous and scared because I'm in no way qualified and you're all my senior Vaishnavas, but I really insisted, so I was just here to do the service, and so I just want to thank you all for bearing me up here.
It's 9 o'clock, so we're going to end, but specific to this ahimsa value,
that both parts of what Dear Krishnamurti presented in Gitanagari is available somewhere up there on YouTube. If you need some help to find that website, maybe you can let her know. She's going to be traveling. You'll have to be able to do that?
Yeah, I can do it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Vamsi Dari, and he'll know where to find everything. You can just find out from him and send it out. Yeah. Whoever sent, you send stuff out, right? Okay. So give the link. Then he can send it out. If you're interested. It's specific to this one principle, but it's an important principle of communicating and the whole series of things, because he taught these principles exactly, like, you know, exhaustively: observation, emotion, needs, request. It's dynamic of relationships that are empathic. And then here's how you do it. So anyway, if you want to learn more about it, you'll get a link that'll, you can see the videos of his teachings. Summarized. Okay, thank you.